You're listening to Recovery, Healing, Outreach, and Awareness, a podcast about domestic violence, sponsored by Randy's House of Angels. Domestic or intimate partner violence is a complex and silent epidemic that affects millions of people worldwide. To respond to the overwhelming issues associated with domestic violence, Randy's House of Angels has produced a series of podcasts that will bring this epidemic to the forefront of public consciousness and break the silence that often shrouds it. This is Paul Miller, producer of this program, and by creating a dedicated platform, Randy's House of Angels hopes to create a safe space for survivors, advocates, and experts to share their stories, insights, and knowledge. A series of topics will be discussed that can offer vital support and resources to victims and survivors, helping them realize that they are not alone and that there is help available. It can also serve as a catalyst for raising awareness and fostering necessary conversations within families, communities, and institutions to empower individuals, foster empathy, and inspire collective action toward eradicating domestic violence while creating a safer, more compassionate society. We invite you to access the podcast by going to randyshouseofangels.org. On today's episode, we will explore the connection between pet abuse and intimate partner violence. We will discuss how abusers may use pets as a means of control and intimidation, and examine the emotional and psychological impact of pet abuse on both victims and the animals involved, and their ongoing challenges. We will discuss how pet abuse intersects with other factors such as socioeconomic status, race, and gender, and look at cultural perspectives on the treatment of animals and its implications. More importantly, we will discuss the importance of training professionals, including law enforcement and social workers, to recognize and address the link between pet abuse and IPV. Joining us today is Dr. Cassandra Reyes. Dr. Reyes is an associate professor of criminal justice at Westchester University. Prior to becoming a professor at WCU in 2009, she worked as a New Jersey State senior bilingual parole officer and probation officer, and Indiana County Jail Correctional Officer for over 13 years. Dr. Reyes is a survivor of a violent intimate partner relationship for 2.5 years, and working with other survivors of intimate partner violence, she returned to IUP for her graduate degrees and focused her research on the link between animal cruelty and domestic violence. Her passion in IPV enabled the creation of the first known criminal justice animal cruelty course in the United States, which has reached more than 1,000 students. Today's podcast facilitator is Sherry Peters. Sherry Peters, a master's level social worker, is a nationally recognized facilitator in the children's mental health field and currently serves on the board of Randy's House of Angels. Formerly the director of the Psychiatric Residential Treatment Facility Waiver Initiative at Georgetown University's National Technical Assistance Center for Children's Mental Health, Ms. Peters also spent 21 years in leadership positions in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania's Office of Mental Health and Substance Abuse Services, addressing children's mental health policy and program development. This includes suicide prevention and trauma-related issues. In her early career, she spent a decade as a therapist in residential and community settings.
So welcome, Cass. It's so nice to have you here today with us. Today's topic is the relationship between domestic violence and pet abuse. And I just want to throw it open to you to say, what do you think is important to understand about that whole idea?
Thank you very much. So with regard to pet abuse and animal domestic violence, approximately 67% of Americans own pets, at least one pet in their household, and that's the statistics as of last year. However, when there are situations with regard to domestic violence, approximately 78% of females who are leaving the situation have stated that have either injured or threatened to kill or have killed their pets. And in these situations, approximately 90% of the children in these households have also seen the abuse. There was a research that was done with regard to child abuse in the home and child neglect in the home. And in these houses, they found that 87% of these households also had animal cruelty in the homes when there are situations of child abuse as well. So when we're looking at pets in the family, 97% of people consider their pets as members of the family. In addition, 66% also consider them as household members. We have people who name their pets with human names. They're considered support animals. Somebody has a bad day at work or a bad day in the office, what have you, and they come home, they console, and they talk to their pet, they pet their pet. They're also used as buffers in situations of domestic violence where the person will turn to their pet as an emotional support situation. We also see situations where the human industry has been turning to the pets as well. We have things such as pet shampoo that's made by Paul Mitchell and others. We have hotels that'll make sure that they have proper amenities for the pets, like a bone on the pillow, those type of things. So we see more and more things being open to family members that are four-legged, two-legged, furry, feathered, what have you.
Right.
The problem is, with regard to domestic violence, since we see a high correlation between the humans being abused or neglected in these households with the animals also being abused, oftentimes it's very difficult for somebody to leave a situation knowing that the pet may be abused in the person's absence. So approximately 75% of people who are survivors of domestic violence will be hesitant to leave these households, and approximately 25% will return because they're worried about what's happening with the pets in their absence. It makes it very difficult because a lot of domestic violence shelters don't have amenities for pets, but there's something called the Safe Havens for Pets, and it has a relationship with animal shelters and domestic violence shelters where people can take their children and their pets and move them away from that situation, which has been very beneficial. The Animal Welfare Institute has been doing a lot of research on this and has a plethora of information about where these shelters are found. There are a lot in Ohio, for example. There aren't as many here in Pennsylvania.
So I'll interrupt you for just a moment and talk a little bit about your experience with families who want to take their pets with them. Shelter isn't able to help them, but maybe the safe haven would be able to actually help to find a place where everyone can be safe. What can people in the general public do to help ensure that there's more availability of this sort of thing so that families can feel like they can leave and they will have a safe place for themselves and for their pets? Is there anything we in the general public can do?
I think it's important for the general public to be aware that this is a situation for domestic violence. Oftentimes people know somebody who's been in some kind of a violent relationship, or they have pets themselves and they've never really thought about what would happen if things do not go so well in the family.
Right, right.
So it's important to talk to legislators. It's important to talk to big corporations who may be sponsor or donate money to different shelters, whether they're human or animal focused, and also help pass more legislation to protect everybody involved. In fact, on April 15th of this year, Governor Shapiro just signed the Cadens Law, which it was primarily focused on child support cases, but it also includes animal cruelty and animals as pets in the households to be protected under this new law under domestic violence situations. So that's something relatively new. We have approximately 37 states here in the United States, including DC and PR, or Puerto Rico, that have some kind of wording in their prevention from violence orders that include the pets, or other states also have some mentioning of the pets in these orders, but not necessarily protect the pets in the process. So it's really important that the public knows that this is going on, what the relationship is between the types of violence, and how they can really be impactful.
How they can advocate. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious to know how our professionals might be trained. I think there's probably some training that if someone has reported, let's say, animal abuse, and the professionals go out to check, they're also perhaps looking for other kinds of people abuse, child abuse, spouse abuse, whatever. Is that actually happening, that there are trainings involving professionals to make sure that they're looking for signs of other abuse? I guess either way, either from going out on a child abuse kind of situation, but also looking for pet abuse. Is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely. So In 2005, a study was done by Barbara Boat, and she indicated that cross-training needed to be done, whether it was a human-based agency or animal-based agency, whether it's child protective services, domestic violence, police departments, that they should be cross-trained and to look for these signs. If the children, for example, are being neglected in the home, are there pets in the home? Are they being taken care of? That's a red flag. If it's somebody who's on the animal control side of it, they also need to be aware of what's going on with the human individuals in the household. Is it a hoarding situation where there's a lot of items all strewn upon the house? Is it a lot of feces and other things from the animals in the place, or children's diapers, those type of things? They should be really cognizant of who all's in that home, whether it's human or non-human. But there's been a lot of push for that. The Keystone Link Coalition here in Pennsylvania is another entity that's helped provide training for this cross-training. And also the Pennsylvania Bar Association, the Animal Law Committee, has provided handbooks for animal control officers to help them know what to look for when they go into these situations. And also police officers, it's really important because they're usually the first responders there. They need to be more informed with what's going on, especially since Libre's law was passed in 2017, making the laws more stringent with regard to animal cruelty, and that all the police agencies need to enforce these laws, even though it's not a priority for them because it's not human-based. So there is cross-training happening. Whether it's a priority, that's another question.
Right, right. So we're not sure how it's working. Yeah, there's certainly efforts afloat to make it happen, right?
Yes.
Okay, so say a little bit more about families who might be reluctant to leave because they don't know what's going to happen to their pets, or even how to find out more about where to take their pets, or if their pets can come with them. Just say a little bit more about that.
Thank you. As I mentioned, about 78% of people are afraid to leave their homes when there's a pet involved in a domestic violence situation. Oftentimes, for example, the abuser may use the pet as a manner to control the victim or the survivor, either threatening to harm the animal, threatening to kill the animal, or actually having the victim or survivor do that same action towards their pets in a manner to control them. They'll also do that to help control the children, and that's where the children are starting to learn these behaviors. They're imitating the behaviors of the abusers. They're starting to explore. They have curiosity, or they may be practicing. If something is happening to the children, they'll look for something that's more vulnerable than they are, so they may turn to the family pet, or they may harm the pet in a method to protect the pet from further harm by the abuser themselves. So it makes it a really difficult situation. When you're thinking about the cycle of violence, when you have the tension building phase and the incident as well, and you think of other control mechanisms that are in place by the abuser and the victim and the survivor, whether it's financial, whether it's educational, whether it's family, using these pets is another manner to control the person, to try to keep them within the situation and prevent them from leaving because they are afraid of what's going to happen next to their pets. But a lot of times we'll see that the abusers will turn to those pets if they can't get to the adults or the children and the family as well.
So how do they turn for help? Is it they call a shelter, they call a helpline? What is it that they need to do to find out how they can safely leave a situation and their pets will be safe?
Well, there are a lot of places that they could call. Pennsylvania has a domestic violence hotline, for one, that they can contact. Pennsylvania also has another organization with regard to domestic violence. And I mentioned the Safe Havens through the Animal Welfare Institute. If they were to go on the website, they can find out where all the Safe Havens shelters are within the United States. They started around 1998, and they've been increasing since then. Not every state has them, but they're at least growing in a method. Or they can also contact the animal shelters. They can contact other people who might be familiar with advocating for both the humans and the animals. They can contact the Pennsylvania SPCA, for example, for ideas as well. So there's a lot of avenues that they can do to find out information about how they could do this. And there's also a Pennsylvania 211 where they can call about domestic violence could possibly help them with regard to the shelter situation.
Did you know it costs about $400 to send a child to Randy's Camp or Randy's Kids Club? If you are interested in sponsoring a child, please contact Nancy Chavez at 717-503-4498 or email randyshouseofangels@gmail.com for more information.
So So even though they might be afraid and might not know initially where to turn, there really are lots of resources if they reach out, and those resources hopefully would be able to help them figure out a way to keep their pets safe. You pointed out in the beginning that many families, the majority of families, consider their pets to be part of the family. And so it's really an important piece of this puzzle in terms of having people get up the courage to leave a violent situation. Mm-hmm. What haven't I asked you that you think is important for our audience to know about?
I think it's important for the audience to know, just to, like I mentioned before, really be aware of the situations. I know that some people think that if somebody's in a domestic violence situation and they don't leave, they victim blame, and they really don't think about why the person's not leaving, whether it's some type of control. They need to be more aware of what the situations are. As someone who's lived those experiences plus work with people in those experiences, it is really hard to let people understand what's going on within the situation, especially if somebody turns a blind eye on that and thinks it's the victim's fault or the survivor's fault in the situation. But the awareness is key with this.
So can you talk a little bit about the idea that children might be showing signs, but they might be keeping secrets about what's happening? Expand on that a little bit.
Sure. So oftentimes we'll see children commit some kind of violence or some kind of act towards their pets. Usually it was believed that there was a situation considered the homicidal triad, which included animal cruelty, fire setting, and uresis, which is bedwetting past the age of 5 or 8. It was believed that children who are committing animal cruelty often lead into other activities. We see it a lot with the serial killers, even though they're far and few between. The Federal Bureau of Investigation has done a lot of research on this and seen a lot of correlations with people, serial killers such as Jeffrey Dahmer and others, Ted Bundy. So many of the serial killers committed animal cruelty, torturing the animals, not necessarily just petting the animals or cutting the hair, those type of things, but actually committing harm to these animals. Whether it's for practicing against a person who's bigger, whether it's something they've seen in the household or things that have happened to them. If we see children doing this on a continual basis, then we know that there's something going on either with the children themselves or they're witnessing it in the home. So it's really important to pay attention to these red flags. Oftentimes we'll see small children using the magnifying glass on an ant, for example. That's exploration or curiosity that might not rise to the level of animal cruelty in these situations, even though it is animal cruelty. But if they're doing something to harm the cat or the dog, other animals that are more tangible and considered more family members, then there are possibly issues going on with that child themselves. So it's really important for whether it's child and youth services, whether it's court system, whether it's teachers, educators, people who are involved in those children's lives to pay attention to these signs to find out whether something also is going on with that child. Also, veterinarians, with regard to forensic veterinary medicine, it's really important that they're paying attention to these things. With regard to injuries that animals may sustain, if they have fur, if they have feathers, if they have scales, it might not be easy to see bruising on an animal, for example. They might not see that until its necropsy is conducted, which is the same as an autopsy on a human. They may see things such as an animal being stabbed in a situation where somebody was harming somebody else in the family. And it's really important that the veterinarians also work with law enforcement and other entities to determine this. And veterinary forensics is a newer field, subfield of animal cruelty prevention and response. And more veterinarians are getting involved with this. And we see a lot of veterinarians, for example, at the Pennsylvania SPCA, who work there, and they're determining these cases, whether it's some kind of injury that's done to the animal, whether it's neglect with an embedded collar, which means the collar is too small for the animal and it's been left in the situation. So it's really important that the veterinarians also work with human doctors too, to make sure if there's something going on with the pets, if their children involved, maybe if their child is being taken to be medical staff, to have that communication open between those two types of medical professions and also help with this problem.
So I'm curious, when you were talking about the whole idea of a pet actually possibly being injured when the perpetrator was trying to injure someone else, is it common for pets to intervene when they see that a person in their family is being abused by another person in their family.
It really depends on the type of animal, the animal's personality. You'll see that more probably with dogs than you would with cats. But the problem in those situations, since animals can't speak and tell us what's going on, they could also act very lovingly towards the abuser who's harming them as well.
Yes,
so it makes it very difficult. It's the same thing with humans. They may act very lovingly towards the person who's abusing them because of the psyche that's involved with it.
Right. That's an important point.
So there's another thing that's happening that's in the process right now. One problem that we see within the judicial system here in Pennsylvania is a lot of judges aren't aware of what the laws are with regard to animal cruelty. Like I said, the newest one being Caden's Law in April. So judges might not be informed of what the laws are. They might not be informed of what the sanctions are in these situations. So the Pennsylvania Bar Association Animal Law Committee is working with the judges at this point to give them better resources to make better decisions in these type of cases and make it more accessible to them. And this is just something that's in the process right now as we're sitting here.
That's important information to know. And I also wonder, this whole idea of witnessing violence against a pet, what is the impact on the individuals, especially for children, but also for the adults in the family? What is that psychological or emotional impact of witnessing the violence?
Well, it definitely has a major impact to these children, whether it's a PTSD or post-traumatic stress disorder. It could be something that could be normalized also, unfortunately, within the households if they see this repeated, and this is the way they find out love, basically what we see in domestic violence situations. They may interpret this as something that's normal. But when somebody has a strict bond or a strong bond with a human or a pet, and we see that entity being damaged in some way, it really impacts the people who are witnessing it or maybe trying to stop it. They may have nightmares. They may have to go to counseling of some sort. But it's really important to check in on these individuals, make sure they get the help they need, get them out of these situations to hopefully help reduce the anxiety or whatever it's inducing in the children, the adult survivors in these situations as well.
Considering the importance of getting help, what are some of the barriers to getting help for these kinds of things?
A lot of the barriers may have to do with whether it's financial, whether they can't go see a doctor, whether it's a medical doctor or a psychological type of doctor, transportation to these entities. If the abuser in the household is controlling access or egress from the house, they might not be able to go out and get the help that they need. Or they might not be able to have the funding that they need to go to a veterinarian for the damage that's done to their pets as well. If they're large animals, if we're talking about farm animals, then the other problem is if the animals were taken out of that situation, where do they go? The shelters may be full. It's not easy to take a horse, for example, and just put him in a shelter.
I would think that's not so easy to do, yeah. So what's the solution then? What could a family do that is worried about their large pets?
I would definitely suggest that they contact the Pennsylvania SPCA or Humane Societies. There's Humane Societies basically in every county here in Pennsylvania. They can contact them. They usually have either farms that they could take the horses to or maybe facilities for them. But having that open dialogue with these type of entities to take the animals out of there. And then also, these type of animal control, animal protection agencies also have the ability within the law to charge the offenders, whether it's serious bodily harm that's done to the animals, aggravated animal cruelty, or animal cruelty. In Pennsylvania, the aggravated animal cruelty could lead up to 2 years imprisonment, for example. It's also considered a felony if it's torturing of an animal, those type of things. If it's neglect, it's considered animal cruelty, and it has lesser consequences because it's considered a misdemeanor or summary here in Pennsylvania. So being open and knowing where the resources are with regard to animal protection in their area is very crucial for them as well to help protect those animals.
So the SPCA would be a place to start.
Yes. And the Pennsylvania SPCA, there's a belief that it's really focused on Philadelphia, but they're actually licensed all the way across Pennsylvania. And they have the ability to go in and do a forensic examination. They take pictures of what's going on in the situation, and they have all the evidence they need for when the case goes to court. And then they have the the forensic veterinarians to work with them. But the problem is another barrier is the resources, the financial resources. Organizations such as Humane Societies or the Pennsylvania SPCA are donor-based. They don't receive any governmental funding. So if they don't have the supporters giving them money, then it makes it more difficult for them to do the jobs. And as I mentioned, another barrier is with regard to police agencies, they're focused more on human types of crimes. Animals will take a less priority in their daily operations, and they might not have the manpower to go out and take care of these cases. So funding is another major resource, not only having the places for them to go, but they also have the funding to take care of them, take care of the injuries, feed them, protect them from the offender. The problem with animals, unlike the problem with humans, animals are still considered property in the law. So if you take someone's animal out of their home and they're the owner, you're removing their property. It's considered chattel because it's movable property. So that creates another issue on getting the rights removed from the owner in order to put the animal in a safe place as well. So oftentimes if Pennsylvania SPCA goes out, they often ask the alleged offender to relinquish the rights to the animal so they can home them and possibly put them in a foster placement. Otherwise, they have to sit in the shelter itself until it goes through the court process.
So that sounds like a really big barrier. And the piece that I was surprised about is that the SPCAs only are funded through donations, which is another message then to send out if there's such a big connection between animal abuse and domestic violence or intimate partner violence, then supporting the SPCAs through our donations is also a way to support our families in violent situations. That was a surprise. Mm-hmm. So we talked a little bit about the impact of a witness to the abuse of a pet, but let's talk a little bit about the impact on the pet when the pet witnesses violence in the home, not necessarily their own abuse, but witnessing the abuse of family members, for instance.
Absolutely. So there is emotional abuse. Anything that's a sentient being would have some type of emotional capacity. Even though they can't say, well, I'm scared of this individual walking into the home, you may see them cower in a corner, or they might go hide if somebody walks into the room, or if somebody raises their voice, for example, or puts their hand up. Oftentimes you'll see the animals cower down. But again, the problem is, like humans, they may not exhibit these type of behaviors. They may be very loving and affectionate and be happy to see the person coming in. So it's really hard to tell because they can't tell us, well, this is what this person did to me or did to the other people in the household. But if they start hiding or if somebody adopts an animal that's been in the situation, it may take a while for them to learn to trust people again. Or maybe a situation where if a man was an abuser, they may be afraid of males. So it's really hard to tell, but there is an impact there you could see. But again, it's not always 100% because they can't tell us what's going on verbally that we'd understand them.
Thank you. That's an important thing to keep in mind. The whole idea of them not being able to tell us what's going on is really frustrating for the people in this situation. We're going to be coming to a close soon, and I wonder if there's anything else that folks in this situation of knowing that they are in an abusive situation or a family member that knows that their loved one is in a situation and they want to be helpful. What are some words of wisdom, I guess?
I think it's important for people, especially if they see a family member going through the situation, to be supportive and be empathetic to the situation. The problem is somebody who's going through the situation might not recognize it or might not be ready to leave. So please don't get frustrated you ask them to come with me, we could stay with us, and they don't do that right away. It may take them time to get out. The average person tries to leave, I think, 8 times before they actually get out of the domestic violence situation.
Yeah, that's a lot of attempts, and not being able to leave is kind of frustrating for the person who cares about the family member or the loved one, and they would like to do more and are just standing by and watching. But as you point out, being supportive in whatever ways they can is an important piece. Last words.
I think it's really important to keep in mind that when we think of interpersonal violence or domestic violence, it's not just the humans that are involved in these situations. If there are pets in the home, please make sure to check on those pets as well. And as you mentioned, be supportive of people you know going through this and just be patient until they're ready to leave.
Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Randy's House of Angels is sponsoring season 2 of a series of podcasts that will serve as a resource to anyone impacted by domestic violence, including parents, guardians, caseworkers, health providers, advocates, teachers, trauma specialists, clinicians, and more, to provide an overview of domestic violence and how to handle situations where domestic violence is present. Season 2 will include a series of 7 podcasts that will include an overview and understanding the link between domestic violence and homelessness, the relationship between domestic violence and pet abuse, how to navigate domestic violence in an LGBTQ+ relationship, understanding teen violence, the challenges of survivors and resilience revolution from victim to victor, and exploring how cultural traditions impact domestic violence. The podcast will include testimony and stories from experts who work in the field of domestic violence, criminal justice, and social work academia, and a survivor who was a victim of the domestic violence. This podcast will be broadcasted starting in July 24 and running through September of 2024. Go to Randy's House of Angels website at randyshouseofangels.org if you missed the podcast, if you'd like any of the resources that support the podcast, and to take a brief survey. Your feedback is essential to shaping and informing future episodes of our show.